On Life Support, Maine's Rural Hospitals. By many measures, rural hospitals are in crisis. Over the past 5 years, Maine's rural hospitals have lost $20 million in revenue, and two this year filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. This is part of a national trend. In the past 9 years, 120 rural hospitals across America have closed, and 2019 was the worst year yet, with 19 closings. Many hospitals that are still operating have cut down on services, closing maternity and birthing centers, cancer treatment facilities, and more. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss the reasons behind the rural hospital crisis, how it affects communities, and what can be done. This show is part of Maine Calling's ongoing focus on issues that affect rural Maine. That's next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. As we all know, Maine is a mostly rural state, and that can present challenges, particularly when it comes to health care. Today, we are talking about Maine's rural hospitals, the challenges they face, and what they are doing to try to provide services to their communities. This show is part of Maine Calling's ongoing focus on rural issues in Maine. Joining me in Portland, Peter Wright with Central Maine Healthcare. He is president of Bridgeton and Rumford Hospitals. Lisa Letourneau is senior advisor of delivery system change for Maine's Department of Health and Human Services. She leads the rural health transformation work for DHHS. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Chris Duty. She is CEO for Carey Medical Center and chair of the American Hospital Association's National Committee on the Future of Rural Healthcare. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you had recent experience with a rural hospital? How was it? Are you concerned about being able to access healthcare in the future? You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Of course, you can always post on our Facebook page, and we welcome all of you who are listening to our live stream of Maine Calling today. Chris Duty, I'm going to start with you. What are some of the biggest issues facing rural hospitals here in Maine and across the country?
Good afternoon, Jennifer. And thanks for the opportunity to talk about rural hospitals, which are obviously very important engines in our rural communities. And a lot of us are facing a lot of the same issues, whether it's workforce issues, trying to find physicians to relocate to our areas, professionals such as nurses, technologists. That seems to be a pretty major concern for a lot of our hospitals, not only here in Maine, but I hear it on our committee for the American Hospital Association. Access to capital. Now, there's a number of hospitals that have had some deferred maintenance and have not made the investments in their hospital, but to come up with the capital to update their facilities has been a challenge for a number of facilities. There's a number of issues, some challenges that are beyond the walls of the hospital, such as some drug prices that are really challenging to hospitals that increase their costs and while reimbursements aren't keeping up. So there's a number of just wild issues that a lot of hospitals across our nation and here in the state of Maine are dealing with.
Sure, and we will dig into them one by one a little bit later on the program. Peter, you just came to Maine not long ago to lead two hospitals in Western Maine. What are you finding you need to focus on the most in helping them succeed?
I think it's the same in Maine as it is in other locations, particularly in rural areas. It's about connections with the community. It's about helping people. We're the safety net, you know. So we're often the last line of defense for the community. Hospitals are often actually physically located on hills, and so we sit up high on that hill as a beacon of strength and community connection. So I worry about the folks in our community who can't get to us because of transportation issues. I worry about folks who come to us in an ambulance because they can't eat well enough, because they can't get to work to afford a healthy lifestyle. We tend to worry just about everything, actually.
I want to bring you into the conversation, Lisa. I've been a reporter in Maine for 25 years, and there's never been a good time to be a rural hospital, but the needs and the challenges are evolving, and especially just in the last few years, correct?
I totally agree.
What are we seeing that we weren't seeing even 5 or 10 years ago? What kind of challenges are Maine's rural hospitals facing?
Well, I think to echo many of the challenges that Chris and Peter have noted, certainly issues related to the shrinking workforce. We hear that in every community. We've made an effort as Maine DHHS to go out and listen in communities, and we hear prime among the concerns of community members, the survivability certainly of their hospitals, transportation, access to behavioral health, particularly substance use disorder treatment. We hear concerns about access to specialists, concern about getting their basic needs met, as Peter mentioned.
Chris, talk to me about what a hospital means for a community, a rural community.
Oh, a hospital is vital to a rural community. A lot of times they're the largest employer in that community, so they provide a lot of resources. They're also a catalyst for bringing a lot of partners together in a community, because not a lot of rural hospitals can provide all services and be all things to all people in their community. So they have to come together. They have to be partners with a lot of other businesses, a lot of other healthcare providers, such as mental health facilities, home health facilities. And they need to partner, and they need to be a convener of bringing those groups together to make sure the services are available for the people in their community.
We're having this conversation, Peter, as Maine has decided to expand Medicaid at the beginning of this year. So about the time that you came to Maine, Maine has implemented Medicaid expansion. Has that made a difference in the solvency of rural hospitals in Maine?
Sure, absolutely. It's always a better scenario when you get something compared to nothing. And most of the Maine care and Medicaid expansion has covered people without insurance. So, you know, one, insurance isn't really a healthcare mechanism. It doesn't make people healthier. It gives them financial security. So what expansion will do is encourage people or drop barriers for folks to come in early on when they're having healthcare issues, as opposed to waiting and waiting and waiting and then coming in through the emergency department. So in my experience looking across the country, The states that have expanded Medicaid have seen a direct improvement in the health, a direct improvement in the access. Why people are surprised that costs went up a little bit, I'm not exactly sure, because when you have insurance, you're going to use it. But we see access to the system earlier. We see improvements in access to primary care. We see our primary care physicians allowing getting connected with patients sooner. And attacking these healthcare issues earlier on.
Is the reimbursement for Medicare and Medicaid enough to keep the hospital solvent? I mean, does the math work?
No, it doesn't. I mean, if you want to look straight on, does in a typical business model, does what Medicaid pay for the services cover their direct cost, the direct cost to provide that care? The answer is often no. It varies from organization to organization, but it's a different shade of gray, really. Does it make the solvency better? Yes. Does it help us shave the pain of the cost shift? So the hospitals in Maine are nonprofit. We're not exporting funds to stockholders like other folks in our industry. So when we get more revenue from our government payers, it allows us to slow and ease the burden on the commercial side. So you and I, who have insurance probably provided by our employers, those rates go up often at double digits to compensate for the impact of what Medicare and Medicaid don't pay. It's nationally known as the cost shift. So that's helpful. That's helpful for everybody.
All right. Lisa, when I introduced you, I said that you lead the rural health transformation work for DHHS. What's underway? What is the shift? Where are we headed?
Yeah, well, we're really excited to be working on this issue. It really starts with a process for community engagement. So I mentioned to do that, we've gone out into communities. So far, we've held listening sessions in 5 rural communities, several of which are also represented in the session today. So up in Caribou, out in Bethel, and several others. It really listened to people in communities. Because I think as much as we are focused today on rural hospitals, I think Chris said it initially, this is really about rural communities, right? What are the needs? So we are out there trying to listen to what people are saying. What are the needs in rural communities? And how do we really work with the range of partners to try to address those, to identify the most important and address those needs? We've also convened a team of experts from around the state to help advise the state on this effort. Additionally, we're looking for ways to strengthen infrastructure in rural communities statewide. So again, several of the issues that have been mentioned, primary care, how do we strengthen primary care? How do we build a more robust system of telehealth, knowing that that is absolutely a critical part of this approach? And workforce issues, as Chris mentioned. Additionally, we're trying to identify regional models of care for services that are very high need but low resourced right now, starting with a focus on perinatal and maternal care, knowing that increasingly hospitals aren't all able to offer OB services, but women in those communities need care. So how do we organize that in a way that makes sense for Maine? And then also, what is a basic sort of model for rural health care, and how do we change payment to support that? Payment methods are really part of one part of the big challenge here right now. Our payment system does not make sense for rural communities. We need to change that.
How so? Explain that.
Well, most rural hospitals are generally paid for the services that they provide. And so they are incented to provide services, even if those services don't always make the most sense for their community. And they're very strapped to maintain the staff to do that. So, for example, general surgery or obstetricians, if that is what they are paid for, and there's absolutely a need in communities, but maybe the best way is not to do that in every single community. But if that is what they're paid for, then they're incented and really sort of forced to provide those services, but they're very expensive. You can't have one general surgeon. You need two or three general surgeons, right, to take call, or one OB. You need two or three. Really expensive for rural communities. Or they have, a small hospital trying to keep the beds full just to pay the bills that then support other services, where it's a very mixed up incentives system, payment system right now.
Peter, out of the corner of my eye, I see you nodding.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think our payment system is upside down. If you look at across the world, the other developed nations and why their cost per capita and why their percent of GDP for healthcare is, on average about a third lower than ours. There's two major factors. One, we spend about two-thirds of our budgets on physical health and about one-third on social services and behavioral health. In every other country, it's completely opposite. They spend a third on physical health and two-thirds on social services and behavioral health. The other part is we get paid to do. We do something, we get paid. So the incentive is for us to continue to do. There are models across the country. The one that comes to mind is an organization called Iora Health, who is providing primary care for Medicaid patients across the country in what's called a capitated or a risk model, which means it's a subscription. You get paid per member per month, and you're responsible for all their care. Well, when you have a fixed fee every month to take care of everybody, your incentives change. All of a sudden, instead of encouraging people to come into the office, you're trying to figure out how to prevent them from coming to the office. So in these Iora clinics, they have health coaches who will call. They know their data very well. They analyze their patients. They know which patients are going to be okay. They know, for example, we have a group of diabetic patients who don't eat well. So we're going to call them every day just quickly and say, hey, did you eat a good healthy breakfast this morning? Did you get your insulin? Do you need a ride to the grocery store? And they will use their budget funds to give someone a ride to the store, because that ride to the grocery store and back gives them the food they need that keeps them out of a very expensive emergency department.
Chris. I'll let Peter finish. I'm sorry about that, Jennifer.
That's okay. I, the other part of it is they start to look at how specialty services are provided. So, there was a great book written, and I think there was an NPR piece done on it about a writer who went to the seven major healthcare systems in the world who had shoulder problems. And, you go to one country and it's, well, we're going to give conservative approach, take some rehab. Another country will give pain meds. The third country would say, well, you're a little bit older. What's your contribution to society? That's a bit of a tough one. But you come to the United States and we get you in the OR on Monday. And it's all about how our incentives align and taking a more conservative, but really evidence-based, research-based approach to healthcare.
Chris?
Yeah, when I mentioned earlier about, and I agree with Peter and Lisa, You know, there's some really creative things that I think a number of rural hospitals are doing, not only here in Maine, but across the nation. And when I mentioned earlier about convening and bringing people together to maximize the resources we have in our rural communities, like our model in particular, we work very, very close with our FQHC, a federally qualified health center. And we've brought together physical health, our primary care providers, behavioral health, and dental, all under one roof. Everybody coming together in what's best for the patients. And we still have some regulatory issues to work through because there's still some antiquated federal regulations that don't necessarily allow a lot of the organizations to work as closely together as they should. But that is a model that can make a difference in a rural community, as Peter describes, that's focused on the patient in bringing all of the those pieces of their health together and doing what we can to keep patients healthy, to get them in the best health of their, so they can, you know, we're not in the situation as Peter described, where we're at a situation of health and keeping people in a better state than waiting till they become so ill or some of the issues that they have are unaddressed, and then caring for them becomes very costly.
Is part of this, Chris, rethinking what a hospital is and what it does?
From my perspective, the hospital is always going to be there, because the reality is patients are going to fall and break a hip, or patients are going to need some preventative care like their endoscopy. I mean, we're always going to have those types of procedures or that type of care. But there are other things that we can be doing, as I just described, like the relationship with our FQHC. And I've actually been at my hospital for almost 40 years. And I think back to when I started, when I was a full-time registered nurse. We have changed a lot. Hospitals actually have changed with and morphed with what the times were. 40 years ago, all 65 beds of my acute care hospital were full at all times. Today, we have half of those beds occupied. So we have changed as our environment has changed. So I don't think that hospitals have not responded to what's occurring in our markets or occurring in just the world as it relates to healthcare. It just that this is a different time of change, and I think the change is happening quickly, and it's primarily because of what's happening in these rural communities. When we talk about factors impacting a hospital, you know, when you have a mill that closes in your town and all of a sudden thousands of people are moving out of your community, a hospital has to respond to that. Things have to change compared to what they were doing before. So I think what we're seeing is a lot of our rural communities are being impacted, which then in turn impacts their local hospital.
Sure, and you're talking about the mill, and that's in Lincoln, where the hospital had to...
Yes.
Chapter 11, the bankruptcy protection this year. Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, I was going to completely agree with Chris. I think what we're doing is we're learning. What we've learned over the years is a lot of the assumptions that we made about how healthcare is delivered and what we do and what we don't do. The more we learn, the less we do. There's a great book written by a physician who worked at Dartmouth. His name is H. Gilbert Welch, and it's More Health and Less Care. And the summation of the book is basically, as we learn more about what we do, as we do more evidence-based research, we learn that the body has an amazing ability to heal itself, and we should be doing less. Two great examples. Why would we give a PSA, a prostate cancer screening, to a man who's 68 years old? Prostate cancer takes 20 years to get you. Right, the statistically, the likelihood that at 68 prostate cancer is going to take you down if you discover it at 68 is minimal, and yet we will test and subject and create anxiety and provide chemotherapy and all those things when the research shows that person will probably succumb to a heart attack, a stroke, or something else. A couple decades ago, we started screening breast cancer for women instead of at 40, at 30. I said, well, we screen earlier, we'll catch cancer earlier, and we'll save lives. So we started screening at 30, and what happened? We found more cancer, and we created more anxiety, and we did more needle biopsies and more surgery and more chemotherapy, but we asked the wrong question. We didn't change mortality. Through all of that, we provided all that care, but we didn't add any value. And if we're honest, I think we took value away because, you know, we created all that anxiety for something we actually couldn't change. And so as we go on and learn more, we're doing less.
All right. Well, we do need to take a quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We're talking about rural hospitals, and we'll be right back.
We don't like to toot our own horn, but if it helps you discover something worth discovering, we'll go there. We're talking about the Maine Public Classical Holiday Stream. We're hearing from listeners everywhere about how much this seasonal service is appreciated. High-quality selections for the holiday, commercial-free, and with very little talk, hardly any. So how do you try it? If you have the Maine Public app, it's one of the radio listening selections. Perhaps you can Bluetooth it from your phone or tablet to your stereo or smart speaker. If you visit our website, it's one of the listening options, or you can click on the classical drop-down. It's holiday music the way holiday music should be, and that is what we're hearing from other listeners. Enjoy. In the weather this afternoon, mostly cloudy in the north, central, and down east, and snow showers later on. Partly sunny in the west and south, mountain squalls late, and snow showers in the south. 20 degrees in the north to 37 degrees in the south. Tonight, evening snow showers for most. Mountain snow squalls eventually dry up. A dusting for most, and several inches for the mountains and mid and down east coast. And windy for all later on. 3 to 15 degrees north to south. And then tomorrow, partly sunny in the north, mostly sunny in the south, with some mountain flurries. Windy and frigid for all. Temperatures ranging from 10 in the north and mountains to 24 in the far south.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the challenges facing rural hospitals in Maine. My guests are Chris Duty, who is CEO of Carey Medical Center. She also heads a national committee on rural health care. Peter Wright is president of Bridgeton and Rumford Hospitals. And Lisa Letourneau heads Rural Health Transformation for Maine DHHS. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before the break, we were talking about how we are thinking, rethinking what a hospital even is. And Lisa, I know you wanted to jump in, but we had to go to a break. So what would you like to add to that part of the conversation?
Well, I just wanted to really underscore something that Chris Duty said and applaud her for her leadership. She mentioned that her hospital, Carey Medical Center, has partnered very closely with the primary care group there, the Federally Qualified Health Center, PINES. And I just wanted to call out just how remarkable that is. It's not easy. I understand there's a lot of antiquated regulations that Chris mentioned, but it's possible. They've done it. That is the only partnership like that that we've seen in the state so far. There are many dozen of these federally qualified health centers. There are many dozen critical access hospitals. And I think it just personifies the kind of cooperation. I think, Chris, if I can quote you, Chris is fond of saying the C in their world is about community, not about competition or control. And I think that's how many rural hospitals, I think, we're starting to see think differently. And we need to keep doing more of that.
On the line with us now,
Lisa,
Dr.
You can call that anytime.
On the line with
anytime, please.
Now, Dr. Norman Dinerman. He is medical director of the Northern Light Eastern Maine Medical Center Transfer Station and Life Flight of Maine. Dr. Dinerman, thanks for calling in.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. It's wonderful to listen to this erudite group of colleagues.
How has what you do changed over recent years as rural hospitals have changed their services?
Well, it's very interesting. We are, focused primarily in the transfer center on the unscheduled demand for care. And we see a need for a lot more decision support for our clinician colleagues.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what this is all about is, I call it tether total talent together, and bringing all the hospitals, the clinicians, the nurses, the administrators, leveraging the creativity of the entire state. And this is not just true in Maine, it's true all over rural America. So what we're concentrating on is how do you provide decision support for a clinician? So as an example, about 37% of the calls that come to our transfer center don't involve requests for transfer, but need decisions supported by our clinicians here at Northern Light Eastern Maine. One clinician speaking with another clinician to kind of affirm a management, reverse a management, redirect a management of a particular patient. And that's all part of supporting a second leg of the, I think, the evolutionary process, which is having everybody practice to top of scope of practice, and then combining it with transport. And those are really three things that from, moving forward is becoming apparent to us at the transfer center, that there is greater and greater need for all three of those components.
And so let me see if I can put this into plain language. You're seeing that 37%, even though you're focused on transporting people from one hospital to another or from an emergency in life flight situation, often from an emergency situation to a hospital, 37% now is really physicians talking with another. Maybe somebody at a rural hospital that doesn't have a certain specialty being able to talk with a specialist and determine whether or not that person needs transport or can be cared for where they are.
That's exactly right, and you've articulated it beautifully. And in so doing, what we really need to look at as a state is what I call hospital resource optimization, so that we're using all of the available beds in the hospital healthcare system around the state. What we do see is Maine Medical Center, Central Maine, Eastern Maine are very over subscribed for people trying to come in. And as Chris mentioned earlier, many community hospitals have beds. So one of the things that we're trying to do from an evolutionary standpoint is to see if we can keep people in their communities, and if they have enough decision support, be it by telemedicine or more traditionally by just telephone, going ahead and enabling clinicians to feel comfortable, confident, and if these patients do deteriorate, to quickly and swiftly move them to a tertiary care hospital, so that you have, in many ways, sort of a demand leveling, but really it's hospital resource optimization, and you really, again, leverage the creativity of everybody in the state, all participating in this tapestry of healthcare that we face.
Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier how have hospitals in rural areas changed over time, and we talked about workforce. One of the things we've noticed, our volumes have gone down, and so we don't have the specialists that we used to. We have access to cardiology a couple days a week, but not every day. We don't have cardiology services on inpatient units frequently in a critical access hospital, access to pulmonologists, infectious disease, all the ologists, if you will. And so these transfer centers, whether it's Northern Light, Central Maine, or at Maine Health, a lot of that collegiality of help me navigate through this patient, right? Whether it's emergency room physician or a hospitalist on an inpatient unit trying to figure out what's going on. A lot of those calls, we see the same statistics at Central Maine. How do we keep the patient here? How do we not transfer to the medical center? It's about providing the right care in the right place at the right time and leveraging our partners to be able to do that, to be able to keep people home, not only because it's a good use of healthcare resources, but when you keep a patient home, their support structure is able to stay engaged. If we have to ship a patient from Rumford to Lewiston or to Portland, now we're making their family and their support structure travel as well. And that has a direct impact on their health. We use the helicopter sparingly. We have an outpost in Lewiston for Life Flight, and actually we're co-owners with Northern Light. We use that sparingly. It's a very expensive tool. And in Maine, as we saw yesterday, weather actually can ground the helicopter for a significant portion of time. So we don't want to rely on that too much. And I know Chris would probably jump right in about how significant both helicopter and fixed wing are to taking care of the patients up there. But those technology, how we use telemedicine, that's going to evolve and really be the saving grace for rural medicine.
Chris, did you want to jump in?
Absolutely, Peter.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Jennifer. And Norm, it's great to have you on the call with us. And I agree with Norman and Peter. What the tertiaries can provide, and as Norm described, practicing to the top of everyone's scope is critical in a rural community. But I also would like to stress one important piece about LifeFlight, our individual ambulances in our communities, is pre-hospital care, which is absolutely critical to rural hospitals and rural medicine. A lot of our individual communities have an ambulance service, either attached to the hospital or attached to the community. Like for us, it's the Caribou Fire and Ambulance, which is part of the municipality. And the importance of pre-hospital care and having those individuals, EMTs, paramedics, in our community is absolutely critical for survivability of a lot of our patients who are brought to our hospital. A lot of the care is provided in the ambulance at the home before they actually get to our hospital to be seen by a physician. And in a lot of rural communities, that is a real big concern because the training EMTs, having enough EMTs and or paramedics in our communities is becoming a big concern. And assuring that we have enough folks in that workforce, that there will be enough people working for the ambulances, working for LifeFlight and other services, that they can provide excellent pre-hospital care so our patients survive in these rural communities.
And Chris, to that point, the Portland Press Herald Maine Sunday Telegram just ran a fantastic series by Colin Woodard about the shortage of and the sort of the edge on which this entire state sits as far as the training and the availability of folks like EMTs and paramedics. But Dr. Exactly. Dinerman, before I let you go, I want to ask you, though, we've been talking about this 37% of people who are not transported, but, you know, hospitals connecting physicians and other specialists to one another. But my understanding is that you are also transporting many, many more patients than you were just a few years ago. Is that true?
That's correct. And part of that is driven by the demographics, Jennifer, in terms of an aging population. Some of it is also driven by advances in medical therapy. So the concept of treating an ST elevation MI, which is fancy doctor talk, for a certain type of heart attack, which can benefit from either lytic agents that dissolve a clot or need thrombectomy to remove a clot, which require specialized services in the case of the thrombectomy at a given center, drives movement of patients from one hospital to another. We also see this with stroke patients, where we can also, with interventional radiology, remove a clot from a large vessel that may be obstructing in the brain. And you can imagine that both thrombectomies for heart attacks and thrombectomies for stroke are time critical, so that if you wish to realize the maximum optimal benefit of the therapeutic procedure or medication, you have to provide it in a very discrete time period. So this drives more and more requests for LifeFlight. I believe we did about 2,237 interfacility transfers last year. 85% of what LifeFlight, the patients we care for, are interfacility transports. Only 15% are seen, and most of the seen, as you might imagine, are trauma. So interfacility transport becomes critical and complements that which Chris talked about in terms of pre-hospital care folks as well. So transport becomes a real, real defining quality for the success of rural healthcare tapestry.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in. That's Dr. Norman Dinerman, Medical Director of Northern Lights Transfer Center and LifeFlight of Maine. We're going to go to a voicemail that came in before the program.
My name is Daniel. I'm calling from Calais, Maine. And regarding rural hospitals, the Calais Hospital has continued to degrade. They closed their OBYN section of over a year ago. You know, no pregnancies there. One of the doctors from the respiratory section left, leaving them unprepared for any respiratory problems. If you have a heart failure, you have to be flown into Bangor. I was admitted there in March, and although they have doctors in the ER, they have no doctors in the hospital itself. You only see an RN if you're admitted to the hospital. Yeah, the place is going to pot.
All right. Well, we don't have anyone here from the Calais Hospital, but Chris, I want to make this a little bit larger. The kind of decisions that are going on there, the same kind of decisions that other hospital CEOs are having to make, for example, not having maternity wards anymore?
Yeah, that's a very unfortunate reality in a lot of rural communities, not only here in Maine, but the years that I sat on the board for the American Hospital Association, we heard it in other parts of our country. One very sad story that I heard when I sat on the board was a hospital in New Mexico that had to close their OB unit because, again, the volume wasn't there. I mean, very similar to like what has happened at Calais Regional Hospital. They were doing 30, 40 deliveries per year. That's not even a delivery per week. And you can't do enough deliveries to make sure that your physicians and nurses are trained to make sure that the patients are in a safe environment. And they had to close their OB service. And the next closest OB service was 150 miles away. And it goes to Dr. Letourneau's point earlier that even though they may not be able to provide the deliveries or the obstetric portion of care to the women in that community, there may be other prenatal and postnatal care that could be provided in some of these communities. Again, these are big decisions that hospitals have to make, but I'm sure they have to look at the well-being of their patients, the well-being of their workforce, and assuring that the workforce has the credentials and the proficiency to ensure that these procedures can be done in their local hospitals. And again, that's not only happening here in the state of Maine, but it's happening across our nation.
Boy, isn't that scary, though, because rural communities need to have young people.
It's a function of the demographics, right? I mean, Maine is the oldest state in the nation, and our young adults are leaving as a concerted effort to try to get them back. But when young adults leave and we have fewer babies, as Chris said earlier, you have to be able to demonstrate competencies in order to keep a service or it's not safe.
Right.
And then you're actually doing a disservice.
It's a catch 22.
Absolutely. The caller made one point about an RN on the inpatient service. It was probably a nurse practitioner. So there, it's illegal. You have to be a credentialed medical staff provider, whether it's a PA, NP, or physician. But the point is made. But the reality is, and part of what we need to change is our expectations. The reality is not everybody needs to see a physician, and that's hard.
Lisa.
And just to chime in behind that, it's, again, Chris pointed out, there are real quality concerns, if volume is that low and if that's the population. But so what do people in that community need? They need access to good prenatal care. They need a safe place where they can go when they're having their delivery, emergency care to make sure if there's anything unexpected happens, and then postnatal care, right? So that doesn't mean that can't happen in that community. It means they can't deliver at that hospital. It's still unfortunate, but the nearest hospital in Maine is 44 miles away. Chris was talking about New Mexico with 100. So it's not, we can't do everything in every community, but we can find new and innovative ways to make sure people get good care. And that was what I was talking about around the state's work on regional models for perinatal care, making sure that we provide education, ensure appropriate transport services for babies and moms, and then good postnatal care. Maybe part of that is care in the community by nurse practitioners, as Peter notes. Maybe it's midwives, which I know Chris uses a lot up in northern Maine. Maybe it's telehealth, just bringing in, which also happens in this state as well, bringing in experts when you need it. So we can do it, and we just need to be creative, innovative, and honestly willing to think differently.
We do need to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. We're talking about rural hospitals. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
2020 is almost here, and Democrats are getting set for another debate over key issues like health care.
I do think it is appropriate to acknowledge that taxes will go up.
And who can beat President Trump?
And if you think a woman can't beat Donald Trump, Nancy Pelosi does it every single day.
I'm Michelle Martin. Join us for live special coverage of the PBS NewsHour Politico-Democratic Debate from NPR News.
That's tomorrow evening at 8 on Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Television. The Maine Public app allows you to take Maine Public Radio and Classical, along with Maine Public Television, with you anywhere and anytime. The Maine Public app is available for both Apple and Android smartphones and tablets. And it also gives you access to many of your favorite television programs from both Maine Public Television and PBS. And it's also easy to either listen to or read Maine Public Radio news reports. You can easily find the Maine Public app in both the Apple App Store and in the Google Play Store, and it's free. Maine Public is pleased to be a media sponsor of Christmas with Kennerly, presented by Friends of the Kochmar Organ this coming Monday evening. This Portland tradition is sure to make your holidays merry and bright with favorite holiday carols performed by Choral Art, the Kochmar Festival Brass, and more. Maine Public members are eligible for 15% off tickets to the concert. Visit mainepublic.org for all the details.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we are talking about rural hospitals and the challenges they face. My guests, Lisa Letourneau with DHHS, Chris Duty with Cary Medical Center, and Peter Wright with Central Maine Healthcare. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now is Andrew Hellman, who is an attorney with Murray, Plum & Murray. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon.
We've asked you to call in because I understand you've worked on some hospital Chapter 11 bankruptcies. And, you know, this used to be a really unusual thing, I understand. But just this year, we've seen two Maine hospitals enter Chapter 11. Tell me some of the thinking behind why that might be appropriate for a rural Maine hospital and whether you expect to see more.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. I'm also chair of the American Bankruptcy Institute's Healthcare Committee. It's a national organization focused on insolvency matters. There have been 20 hospital bankruptcies nationwide so far, three of them in northern New England, two in Maine, one in Vermont. My firm's involved in those cases. And what we often see is that rural hospitals, where there have been population shifts and demographic changes, are increasingly reliant on government payers like Medicare and Medicaid, and the rates they pay are not high enough for these businesses to be able to live within some of the pre-existing operational structures that they have. And bankruptcy provides a tool to get some breathing room from creditors so that they have room to restructure operations and to negotiate a debt restructuring plan and emerge from the other side with a cleaner balance sheet and hopefully be able to provide vibrant health care for many, many years to come.
Do you expect more in the coming year or two?
I think that I would be very surprised if there are not more. Absolutely.
Mm. You know, you're talking about the way bankruptcy could be used as a tool, but aren't the underlying problems the same even when that hospital emerges from or tries to emerge from bankruptcy?
Not always. Look, there are lots of different reasons why a company will file for Chapter 11 that can range from a single disruptive event. There can be a market shift. There can be changes in the company at a leadership level. I'm aware of at least one hospital that had a major employer close in the community where the business was located, and this caused a decline in patient volume and then again a shift from more commercial insurance to more government insurance. And so it required a retooling of the business in order to be able to stay vibrant going forward.
All right. Well, thanks so much for calling in. That was Andrew Hellman. He's an attorney with Murray, Plum, and Murray. And Peter, this is something you wanted to talk about, a way forward, a way so that we're not talking about hospitals declaring bankruptcy or, as we are seeing in more than 100 across the nation, closing.
Yeah, as he said, there was one in Vermont, and I where I came from in New Hampshire was just across the river. So unfortunately, I had the opportunity to watch that unfold. And it's very sad. It undermines not only the viability of the hospital, but the viability of the community. I mean, the community was rocked as that was happening. So it's really sad. I think this has to go to do with payment innovation, how we get paid. Rural hospitals have had their balance sheets, thinned out tremendously over the last couple of decades. And so, as Andrew said, any volatility in revenue produces a dramatic effect, since most of our cost is fixed. Facility and people are fixed. We can scale that somewhat to volume, but if you have the same volume but a different payer mix, you become financially vulnerable. And so this idea of payment intervention, the idea of going to what we talked about earlier, to what's called capitation, where you basically get a subscription fee. You get a fee every month for every member that's a part of your group, your roles, as they're assigned to you. And then your motivations change, right? Instead of motivating them to come into the office, you're trying to figure out how to get them to stay out of the office. Instead of having multiple heart centers across. We have multiple heart centers across the state of Maine. Perhaps we could have one or two. And you're focused on cost and quality. Who can provide that service at the highest quality possible and at the lowest cost? And this idea of center of excellence, we start to, I hate to use the word ration because it makes people very nervous, but we start to right-size the capacity of the healthcare system to the need and really allow folks to become experts.
So you're talking about how great it would be if there were payment innovation and how essential it is. And I'm going to turn to you for this, Lisa. Is it possible? Is this going to happen?
We think it is. The federal government, through the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, have announced earlier this year that they plan to launch what they're calling a rural health payment pilot or pilots. They've started with this in one state, in Pennsylvania, already. They've had a pilot in place for, I think, about a year and a half or so, and doing exactly what Peter has just been referencing, basically paying the hospital a set amount of money to deliver services that make sense for the community, not forcing their hand to be doing procedures just to get money for those procedures. The government hasn't said exactly what that will look like yet, but they're very clear that it will be focused on communities. So it will certainly include, importantly, hospitals, but they'll be looking for other members of the community, like community-based organizations, maybe our area agencies on aging, similar kinds of community-based organizations, members of the community. And they'll be looking to get communities from many different states. So we're very hopeful and we're trying to get ready to help at least several communities in Maine ideally participate in that.
We have a tweet, and I'm going to send this one up to you, Chris. How does the struggle of rural hospitals impact employees? Many rural hospitals have to reduce hours, forego wage increases, etc. Is this an unfair burden on those employees?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I often have said in my 20 years as being the CEO, that I feel a lot of our healthcare workers are not paid for the hard work that they do, not paid well for the hard work that they do every day. And by having some of these challenges in our rural communities, a lot of raises have not been provided to our employees. Services may have changed, and of course it impacts the employees. It impacts their families. Some folks may move out of their rural community to go to another area so they can have a different opportunity or different income. So absolutely, as we've seen some of the challenges in some of the rural communities, as mentioned earlier from Daniel, the call from Callis, when they closed their OB service, obviously that impacted their entire OB staff, their OB nurses, whether they had nurse midwives or obstetricians, they were all impacted by that, which again in turn impacts their local community. I think our staff work extremely hard in our hospitals, and for those who've been working in hospitals for many decades, we see our staff in some pretty difficult situations, whether in the emergency room or patients who we can't get placed, and a lot of times our nurses, our technologists are in a really tough situation, and I'd love to pay them a whole lot more for all the hard work that they do every single day.
We're running short on time, and there's something we really haven't talked that much about, and that's the staffing in hospitals. And I'll turn to you, Peter, and ask you, it seems to be a theme in these Maine Calling programs how Maine has a shortage of teachers, Maine has a shortage of nurses, Maine has a shortage of physicians. How difficult is it for you to recruit physicians, nurses, other specialists to the hospitals in Bridgeton and Rumford?
There isn't anybody on our staff role that it isn't hard to recruit. Every single position, environmental services, culinary services, physicians, some are local, some are regional, and some are national searches, but it's hard to fill every position. The unemployment rate in Portland here is, I think, under 2%. Across the state, it's hovering around 3, plus or minus, depending upon the region. Anytime it's under 5, we're, it's a labor crunch. We affectionately say we don't have a labor pool in Maine. We have a labor puddle. And what it's going to drive us to do is, it's actually somewhat a good thing. What it's going to do is it's going to drive us towards, investing more in artificial intelligence and taking tasks and positions that can be automated and automate them and take those staff and invest in them and have them do other jobs.
That's so interesting, because I thought what you're going to say is it's going to make us turn to the children and give them incentives to go into healthcare or to encourage them to go to medical school.
I think Chris would agree with me. The incentives out there right now that we are using to attract, I mean, there is a war going on between facilities. There are 50, it's not uncommon to have a $15,000 sign-on bonus now for a staff-level position. That's amazing. It's a war. And staff, fortunately for most of the hospitals, staff are very connected to their community. They're very connected to their hospital, and there's a lot of loyalty. There is some segment of the workforce who is just traveling to where the highest incentive and the highest dollar amount is.
Mm. We'll go to Bob on Facebook. He says, universal health care in one form or another could ensure that basic and emergency health care remains readily available across rural America. Reducing barriers for people and accessing health care would save lives, as well as the costs of care that is often delivered far later than it should be. There is ample money in today's inefficient healthcare system to streamline services and access across the nation. In about a minute, Lisa, is Bob right?
Well, I certainly agree that universal access to care, so as our state has done, expanding Medicaid through the main care program is one critical part of that. Then how do you deliver? How do you pay for the services? Complete agreement that we need to change that, particularly change payment. Are we going to get to a universal payer? you tell me, Jennifer, there's a lot of different opinions out there. I think absolutely agree. $3.6 trillion on healthcare is enough. We need to do it differently.
All right. And Chris, I'm going to give you the last word because of your perspective on the national scene. What is the future of rural hospitals? Are we going to see another 120 closures in the next 5 or 6 years?
I can't predict whether there'll be 120 closures in the next year, but I think we're going to see rural hospitals looking different, just as we have over the last number of decades. Hospitals have had to change or morph based on what's happening in their community, and I think we're going to see more of that going forward. What that exactly looks like, I don't think any one of us can absolutely predict as we sit here today, but I think we will see a lot more collaboration, a lot more connectivity, a lot more use of technology in like telemedicine, telehealth, looking at workforce, trying to do some innovative ideas through workforce. And again, just leveraging the resources that we have in our rural community to maximize what we are providing for care in our rural hospitals and being there for whatever services we are able to provide.
Well, I thank you all for joining me today for Maine Calling. The voice you just heard, Chris Doody, CEO for Cary Medical Center and chair of the American Hospital Association's National Committee on the Future of Rural Healthcare. Peter Wright is here with Central Maine Healthcare, president of Bridgeton and Rumford Hospitals, and Lisa Letourneau, senior advisor of delivery system change for Maine's Department of Health and Human Services, and she leads the DHHS Rural Health Transformation work. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. We had additional help from Nick Woodward. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.